She bowed in wonder as she followed him, running her fingers over the carefully designed tiles.
Is this part of the Pantheon?
No.
Then is this place real?
It's real in your mind, said Chagan. That's as real as anything gets.
Jiang never taught me about this.
That's because you Nikara are so primitive, said Chagan. You still think there's a strict binary between the material world and the Pantheon. You think calling the gods is like summoning a dog from the yard into the house. But you can't conceive of the dream world as a physical place. The gods are painters. Your material world is a canvas, and this divinatory is an angle from which we can see the colors on the palette. This isn't really a place. It's a perspective. But you're interpreting it as a room because your human mind can't process anything else.
What about this altar? The mosaics? Who built them?
No one did. You still don't understand. They're mental constructions so that you can comprehend concepts that are already written. To the Talwu, this room looks completely different.
The Talwu?
Chagan tilted his head toward something in front of them.
You're back so soon, spoke a cool alien voice.
In the dim light, Rin had not noticed the creature standing behind the hexagonal altar. It walked around the circle at a steady pace and sank into a deep bow before Chagan. It looked like nothing Rin had ever seen. It was similar to a tiger, but its hair grew 2 feet long. It had a woman's face, a lion's feet, a pig's teeth, and a very long tail that might have belonged to a monkey.
She is a goddess, guardian of the hexagrams, Chagan said to Rin as he sank into an equally deep bow.
He pulled her down to the floor with him.
The Talwu dipped her head toward Chagan.
The time of asking has expired for you. But you, she looked at Rin, you have never asked a question of me. You may proceed.
What is this place? Rin asked Chagan. What can it... she... tell me.
The divinatory keeps the hexagrams, he answered. The hexagrams are 64 different combinations of lines broken and unbroken.
He indicated the calligraphy at the sides of the altar, and Rin saw that each character indeed was made up of 6 lines.
Ask the Talwu your question. Cast a hexagram, and it will read the lines for you.
It can tell me the future?
No one can divine the future, said Chagan. It is always shifting, always dependent on individual choices. But the Talwu can tell you the forces at play, the underlying shape of things, the color of events to pass. The future is a pattern dependent on the movements of the present, but the Talwu can read the currents for you, just as a seasoned sailor can read the ocean. You need only present a question.
Rin was beginning to see the reason why Chagan commanded the fear that he did. He was just like Jiang, unthreatening and eccentric, until one understood what deep power lay behind his frail facade. How would Jiang pose a question? She contemplated the wording of her inquiry for a moment. Then she stepped toward the Talwu.
What does the Phoenix want me to know?
The Talwu almost smiled.
Cast the coins 6 times.
3 coins suddenly appeared, stacked on the hexagonal altar. They were not coins of the Nikara Empire. They were too large, cut into a hexagonal shape rather than the round tails and ingots Rin was familiar with. She picked them up and weighed them in her palm. They were heavier than they looked. On the front side of each was etched the unmistakable profile of the Red Emperor. On the back were inscribed characters of old Nikara that she could not decipher.
Each throw of the coins will determine 1 line in the hexagram, said Chagan. These lines are patterns written into the universe. They are ancient combinations, descriptions of shapes that were long before either of us was born. They will not make sense to you, but the Talwu will read them, and I will interpret.
Why must you interpret?
Because I am a seer. This is what I'm trained to do, said Chagan. We hinterlanders do not call the gods down as you do. We go to them. Our shamans spend hours in trances, learning the secrets of the cosmos. I have spent more time in the Pantheon than I have in your world. I have deciphered enough hexagrams now to know how they describe the shape of our world. And if you try to interpret for yourself, you'll just get confused. Let me help you.
Fine. Rin flung the 3 coins out onto the hexagonal altar. All 3 coins landed tails up.
The first line, undivided, read the Talwu. One is ready to move, but his footprints run crisscross.
What does that mean? Rin asked. Chagan shook his head.
Any number of things. The lines each assume shades of meaning depending on the others. Finish the hexagram.
She tossed the coins again. All heads.
The second line, divided, read the Talwu. The subject ascends to his place in the sun. There will be supreme good fortune.
That's good, isn't it? Rin asked.
Depends on whose fortune it is, said Chagan. The subject is not necessarily you.
Her third toss saw 1 head, 2 tails.
The third line divided. The end of the day has come. The net has been cast on the setting sun. This spells misfortune.
Rin felt a sudden chill. The end of an era. The setting sun on a country. She hardly needed Chagan to interpret that for her. We're not going to win this war, are we? She asked the Talwu.
I only read the hexagrams, said the Talwu. I confirm and deny nothing.
It's the net I'm concerned about. It's a trap, said Chagan. We've missed something. Something's been laid out for us, but we can't see it.
Chagan's words confused Rin as much as the line itself did, but Chagan commanded her to throw the coins again. 2 tails, 1 head.
The fourth line, undivided, read the Talwu. The subject comes, abrupt with fire, with death, to be rejected by all. As if an exit, as if an entry, as though burning, as though dying, as though discarded.
That one is quite clear, said Chagan,
although Rin had more questions about that line than the others. She opened her mouth, but he shook his head.
Throw the coins again.
The Talwu looked down.
The fifth line, divided. The subject is with tears flowing in torrents, groaning in sorrow.
Chagan looked stricken.
Truly?
The hexagrams do not lie, the Talwu said.
Her voice was devoid of emotion.
The only lies are in the interpretation.
Chagan's hand shook suddenly. The wooden beads of his bracelet clattered, echoing in the silent room. Rin shot him a concerned look, but he only shook his head and motioned for her to finish. Arms heavy with dread, Rin cast the coins a 6th and final time.
A leader abandons their people, read the Talwu. A ruler begins a campaign. One sees great joy in decapitating enemies. This signifies evil.
Chagan's pale eyes were open very, very wide.
You have cast the 26th hexagram. The net, announced the Talwu. There is a clinging and a conflict. Things will come to pass that exist only side by side. Misfortune and victory. Liberation and death.
But the phoenix, the woman. Rin had not received any of the answers she wanted. The Talwu hadn't helped her at all.
It had only warned of even worse things to come.
Things she didn't have the power to prevent.
The Ta'ul lifted a clawed hand.
Your time of asking is up. Return in a lunar month, and you may cast another hexagram.
Before Rin could speak, Chagan knelt forward hastily and dragged Rin down beside him.
Thank you, Enlightened One,
he said, and to Rin he murmured,
Say nothing.
The room dissolved as she sank to her knees, and with an icy jolt, like she had been doused in cold water, Rin found herself shoved back into her material body. She took a deep breath. She opened her eyes. Beside her, Ta'gon drew himself up to a sitting position. His pale eyes were huge, deep in their shadowed sockets. His gaze seemed to be focused still on something very far away, something entirely not in this world. Slowly, he returned to himself. And when he finally registered Rin's presence, his expression became one of deep anxiety.
We must get Alten, he said.
If Alten was surprised when Ta'gon barged into the Sihong warehouse with Rin in tow, he didn't show it. He looked too exhausted for anything to faze him at all.
Summon the Psyche, said Ta'gon. We need to leave the city.
On what information? Alten asked.
There was a hexagram.
I thought you didn't get another question for a month.
It wasn't mine, said Ta'gon. It was hers.
Alten didn't even glance at Rin.
We can't leave Curdaline. They need us now more than ever. We're about to lose the city. If the Federation gets through us, they enter the Heartland. We are the final front.
You are fighting a battle the Federation does not need to win, said Ta'gon. The hexagram spoke of a great victory, and great destruction. Curdaline has only been a frustration for both sides. There is one other city that Mugen wants right now.
That's impossible, said Alten. They cannot march to Golden Nice so soon from the coast. The Golden River route is too narrow to move troop columns. They would have to find the mountain pass.
Ta'gon raised his eyebrows.
I'll bet you they've found it.
All right. Fine.
Alten stood up.
I believe you. Let's go.
Just like that? Rin asked. No due diligence?
Alten walked out of the room and headed down the hallway at a brisk stride. They scurried to keep up with him. He descended the steps of the warehouse until he stood before the basement cellar where the Federation prisoner was kept.
What are you doing? Rin asked.
Due diligence,
Alten said, and yanked the door open. The cellar smelled strongly of defecation. The prisoner had been shackled to a post in the corner of the room, hands and feet bound, a cloth jammed into his mouth. He was unconscious when they entered the room. He didn't stir when Alten slammed the door shut, or when Alten crossed the room to kneel down beside him. He had been beaten. One eye was swollen a violent shade of purple, and blood was crusted around a broken nose. But the worst damage had been inflicted by the gas. What skin was not purple had blistered into an angry red rash, so that his face did not look human at all, but rather like a frightening combobulation of colors. Rin found a savage satisfaction in seeing the prisoner's features as burned and disfigured as they were. Alten touched two fingers to an open wound on the prisoner's cheek and gave a small, sharp jab.
Wake up,
he said in fluent Mugini.
How are you feeling?
With a groan, the prisoner slowly opened his swollen eyes. When he saw Alten, he hacked and spat out a gob of spit at Alten's feet.
Wrong answer,
said Alten, and dug his nail into the cut. The prisoner screamed loudly. Alten let go.
What do you want?
The prisoner demanded. His Mugini was coarse and slurred. A far cry from the polished accent Rin had studied at Synegard. It took her a moment to decipher his dialect.
It occurs to me that Curdaline was never the main target,
Alten said casually, resting back on his haunches.
Perhaps you would like to tell us what is.
The prisoner smiled an awful, bloody-faced smile that twisted his burn scars.
Curdeline, he repeated, rolling the Nikata word through his mouth like a wad of phlegm. Who would want to capture this shithole?
Never mind, said Alton. Where is the main offensive going?
The prisoner glowered up at him and snorted. Alton raised a hand and slapped the prisoner on the blistered side of his face. Rin winced. By targeting the prisoner's sore, open wounds, Alton was making him hurt worse and more acutely than any heavy-handed blows could.
Where is the other offensive? Alton repeated.
The prisoner spat blood at Alton's feet.
Answer me!
Alton shouted. Rin jumped. The prisoner raised his head.
Nikata swine, he sneered.
Alton grabbed the prisoner by a fistful of hair in the back of his head. He slammed his other fist into the prisoner's already bruised eye. Again, and again. Blood flew across the room, splashed against the dirt floor.
Stop, Rin squeaked.
Alton turned around.
Leave the room or shut up, he said.
At this rate, you'll pass out, she responded, her heart hammering. And we don't have time to revive him. Alton stared at her for a wild-eyed moment. Then he nodded curtly and turned back to the prisoner.
Sit up.
The prisoner muttered something none of them could understand. Alton kicked him in the ribs.
Sit up!
The prisoner spat another gob of blood on Alton's boots. His head lolled to the side. Alton wiped his toe on the ground with deliberate slowness, then knelt down in front of the prisoner. He stuck two fingers under the prisoner's chin and tilted his face up to his own in a gesture that was almost intimate.
Hey, I'm talking to you, he said. Hey, wake up!
He slapped the prisoner's cheeks until the prisoner's eyes fluttered back open.
I have nothing to say to you,
the prisoner sneered. You will, Alton said. His voice dropped in pitch, a sharp contrast from his previous shouts.
Do you know what a spearly is?
The prisoner's eyes furrowed together in confusion.
What?
Surely you know,
Alton said softly. His voice became a low, velvety purr.
Surely you've heard tales of us. Surely the island hasn't forgotten. You must have been a child when your people massacred Spear. No. Did you know they did it overnight? Killed every single man, woman, and child.
Sweat beaded at the prisoner's temples, dripping down to mingle with fresh rivulets of blood. Alton snapped his fingers before the prisoner's eyes.
Can you see this? Can you see my fingers? Yes or no?
Yes,
the prisoner said hoarsely. Alton tilted his head.
They say your people were terrified of the Spearlies, that the generals gave orders that not one single Spearly child should survive, because they were so terrified of what we might become. Do you know why?
The prisoner stared blankly forward. Alton snapped again. His thumb and index finger burst into flames.
This is why,
he said. The prisoner's eyes bulged with terror. Alton brought his hand close to the prisoner's face, so that the edge of the flame licked threateningly at the gas blisters.
I will burn you piece by piece, said Alton.
His tone was so soft that he could have been speaking to a lover.
I will start with the bottoms of your feet. I will feed you one bit of pain at a time, so you will never lose consciousness. Your wounds will cauterize as soon as they manifest, so you won't die from blood loss. When your feet are charred, coated entirely in black, I'll move on to your fingers. I'll make them drop off one by one. I will line up the charcoal stubs in a string to hang around your neck.
When I've finished with your extremities, I'll move on to your testicles. I will singe them so slowly you will go insane from the agony.
Then
you'll sing.
The prisoner's eyes twitched madly, but still he shook his head. Alton's tone softened even further.
It doesn't have to be like this. Your division let us take you. You don't owe them anything.
His voice became soothing and hypnotic, almost gentle.
The others wanted to have you put to death, you know. Publicly executed before the civilians. They would have had you torn apart. An eye for an eye.
Alton's voice was so lovely. He could be so beautiful, so charismatic when he wanted to be.
But I'm not like the others. I'm reasonable. I don't want to hurt you. I just want your cooperation.
The soldier's throat bobbed. His eyes darted across Alton's face. He was hopelessly confused, trying to get a read and concluding nothing. Alton wore two masks at the same time, feigned two contrasting entities, and the prisoner did not know which to expect or pander to.
"Tell me, and I can have you released," Alton said gently. "Tell me, and I'll let you go."
The prisoner maintained his silence.
"No."
Alton searched the prisoner's face.
"All right."
His flames doubled in intensity, shooting sparks through the air. The prisoner shrieked,
"Colonies!"
Alton kept the flames held perilously close to the prisoner's eyes.
"Elaborate." "We never needed to take Curdeline,"
spat the prisoner.
"The goal was always Golanice. All your best divisions came flocking to the coast as soon as this war started. Idiots. We never even wanted this beach town."
"But the fleet," said Alton. "Curdeline has been your point of entry for every offensive. You can't get to Golanice without going through Curdeline."
"There was another fleet," hissed the prisoner. "There have been many fleets. Sailing south of this pathetic city. They found the mountain pass. You poor idiots. Did you think you could keep that a secret? They're cutting straight toward Golanice itself. Your war capital will burn. Our armed forces are cutting directly across your heartland, and you're still holed up here in this pathetic excuse for a city."
Alton drew his hand back. Rin flinched instinctively, expecting him to lash out again. But Alton only extinguished his flame and patted the prisoner condescendingly on the head.
"Good boy,"
he said in a low whisper.
"Thank you."
He nodded to Rin and Chagan, indicating they were about to leave.
"Wait,"
the prisoner said hastily.
"You said you'd let me go."
Alton tilted his face up to the ceiling and sighed. A thin trickle of sweat ran from the bone under his ear down his neck.
"Sure,"
he said.
"I'll let you go."
He whipped his hand across the prisoner's neck. A spray of blood flew outward. The prisoner bore an astonished expression. He made a last startled, choked noise. Then his eyes drooped closed and his head slumped forward. The smell of cooked meat and burned blood filled the air. Rin tasted bile in the back of her throat. It was a long while before she remembered how to breathe. Alton rose to his feet. The veins at his neck protruded in the dim light. He took a deep breath and then exhaled slowly, like an opium smoker, like a man who had just filled his lungs with a drug. He turned toward them. His eyes glowed bright red in the darkness. His eyes were nothing
human. Fine.
He said to his lieutenant.
"You were right."
Chagan hadn't moved throughout the entire interrogation.
"I'm rarely wrong," said Chagan.
Part 3, Chapter 21.
Baji yawned loudly, winced, and pulled his neck far to the side. A series of cracks punctuated the still morning air. There was no room to lie down in the river sampan, so sleep had to be acquired in short, fitful bursts, bent over in cramp-inducing positions. He blinked blearily for a minute, and then reached across the narrow boat with his foot to nudge Rin's leg.
I can take watch now.
I'm fine, Rin said. She sat huddled with her hands shoved into her armpits, slumped forward so that her head rested on her knees. She stared blankly out at the running water.
You really should get some sleep.
Can't.
You should try.
I've tried, Rin said shortly. Rin could not silence the Tawu's voice in her head. She had heard the hexagram uttered only once, but she was unlikely to forget a single word. It had been seared into her mind, and no matter how many times she revisited it, she could not interpret it in a way that did not leave her feeling sick with dread.
Abrupt with fire, with death, as though burning, as though dying. The subject is with tears flowing in torrents. Great joy in decapitating enemies.
She used to think divination was a pale science, a vague approximation if valuable at all. But the Talwu's words were anything but vague. There was only one possible fate for Golan Nis.
You have cast the 26th hexagram. The net.
Chagan had said the net meant a trap had been laid. But had the trap been laid for Golan Nis? Had it already been sprung? Or were they heading straight toward their deaths?
You're going to wear yourself out. Fretting won't make these boats run any faster.
Baji pulled his head to the side until he heard another satisfying crack.
And it won't make the dead come back to life.
They raced up the Golan River, making absurd time in a journey that should have taken a month on horseback. Aracha ferried them along the river at blinding speed. Still, it took them a week to travel the length of the Golan River to the lush delta where Golan Nis had been built. Rin glanced up to look at the boat at the very fore, where Alten sat. He rode beside Chagan. Their heads were tilted together, speaking in low tones as usual. They had been like this since they had left Curdaline. Chagan and Kara may have been linked as anchor twins, but it was Alten whom Chagan seemed bonded to. Why isn't Chagan commander? She asked. Baji looked confused.
What do you mean?
I don't understand why Chagan obeys Alten, she said. Against the woman, he had proclaimed himself the most powerful shaman in existence. She believed it. Chagan navigated the spirit world like he belonged there, as if he were a god himself. The psych didn't hesitate to talk back to Alten, but she had never seen any of them dare to so much as contradict Chagan. Alten commanded their loyalty, but Chagan enjoyed their fear.
He was slated to be commander after Tyr, said Baji. Got shunted to the side after Alten showed up, though.
And he was fine with that? Rin couldn't imagine someone like Chagan relinquishing authority peacefully.
Of course not. Nearly spit fire when Tyr started favoring the golden boy from Sinigard over him.
So then why—
Why is he happy serving under Alten? He wasn't, at first. He bitched about it for a straight week, until Alten finally got fed up. He asked Tyr for permission for a duel and got it. He took Chagan out into the valleys for 3 days.
What happened? Baji snorted.
What happens when anyone fights Trangson? When Chagan got back, all that pretty white hair was singed black and he was obeying Alten like a whipped dog. Our friend from the hinterlands might shatter minds, but he couldn't touch Trangson. No one can.
Rin dropped her head back onto her knees and closed her eyes against the light from the rising sun. She hadn't slept, hadn't truly rested since they'd left Curdaline. But her body couldn't sustain itself any longer. She was so tired. Their boat jolted in the water. Rin snapped up to a sitting position. They had bumped straight into the boat in front of them.
Something's in the water!
Ramsa shouted from the fore. Rin looked over the side and squinted at the river. The water was the same muddy brown, until she glanced upstream. At first she thought it was a trick of the light, an illusion of the sun's rays. And then her boat reached an odd patch of colored water, and she draped her fingers over the edge. Then she yanked it back in horror. They were riding through a river of blood. Alten and Chagan both jumped up with startled exclamations. Behind them, Unegan uttered a long, inhuman shriek.
"Oh, gods,"
Baji said, over and over.
"Oh, gods! Oh, gods! Oh, god!"
Then the bodies began to float toward them. Rin was paralyzed, stricken with an irrational fear that the bodies might be the enemy, that they would rise out of the water and attack them. Their boat stopped moving completely. They were surrounded by corpses. Soldiers, civilians, men, women, children. They were uniformly bloated and discolored. Some of their faces were disfigured, slashed apart. Others were simply blank, resigned, bobbing listlessly in the crimson water as if they had never been living, breathing bodies. Chagan reached out to examine a young girl's blue lips. His own mouth was pursed dispassionately as if he were tracking a footprint, not touching a rubbery carcass.
"These bodies have been in the river for days. Why haven't they drifted out to sea yet?"
"It's the Golden East Dam," Unegan suggested. "It's blocking them up."
"But we're still miles out from the city." Rin trailed off. They fell silent. Alten stood up at the head of his boat.
"Get out. Start running."
The road to Golden Nis was empty. Kata and Unegan scouted ahead but reported no sign of enemy combatants. Yet evidence of Federation presence was obvious everywhere they looked. Trampled grass, abandoned campfires, rectangular patches in the dirt where tents had been erected. Rin felt sure that Federation soldiers were lying in wait for them, setting an ambush. But as they drew closer to the city, she realized that made no sense. The Federation wouldn't have known they were coming, and they wouldn't have set such an elaborate trap for such a small squadron. She would have preferred an ambush. The silence was worse. If Golan Nis were still under siege, the Federation would be on guard. They would be prepared for skirmishes. They would have posted guards to make sure no reinforcements could reach the resistance inside. There would be a resistance. But the Federation seemed to have simply packed up and walked away. They hadn't even bothered to leave behind a skeleton patrol, which meant that the Federation didn't care who came into Golan Nis. Which meant that whatever lay behind those city walls, it wasn't worth guarding. When the psych finally succeeded in dragging open the heavy gates, an appalling stink assaulted them like a slap to the face. Rin knew the smell. She had experienced it at Synegard and Curtaline. She knew what to expect now. It had been a fool's hope to expect anything different. But still she could not fully register the sight that awaited them when they passed through the barrier. All of them stood still at the gates, unwilling to take one step farther inside. For a long time none of them could speak. Then Namsa fell to his knees and began to cackle with laughter.
"Curdeline!"
he gasped.
"We were all so obsessed with holding Curdeline!"
He doubled over, sides shaking with mirth, and beat his fists against the dirt. Rin envied him. Golan Nis was a city of corpses. The bodies had been arranged deliberately, as if the Federation had wanted to leave a greeting message for the next people to walk into the city. The destruction possessed a strange artfulness, a sadistic symmetry. Corpses were piled in neat, even rows, forming pyramids of 10, then 9, then 8. Corpses were stacked against the wall. Corpses were placed across the street in tidy lines.
Corpses were arranged as far as the eye could see. Nothing human moved. The only sounds in the city were wind rustling through debris, the buzzing of flies, and the squawking of carrion birds. Rin's eyes watered. The stench was overwhelming. She looked to Alton, but his face was a mask. He marched them stoically down the main street into the city center, as if he was determined to witness the full extent of the destruction. They marched in silence. The Federation handiwork became more elaborate the deeper they traveled into the city. Close to the city square, the Federation had arrayed the corpses in states of incredible desecration, grotesque positions that defied human imagination. Corpses nailed to boards. Corpses hung by their tongues from hooks. Corpses dismembered in every possible way. Headless, limbless, displaying mutilations that must have been performed while the victim was still alive. Fingers removed, then stacked in a small pile beside stubby hands. An entire line of castrated men, severed penises placed delicately on their slack-jawed mouths.
One sees great joy in decapitating enemies.
There were so many beheadings. Heads stacked up in neat little piles, not yet so rotted that they had become skulls, but no longer resembling human faces. Whatever heads retained enough flesh to form expressions were identical looks of terrible dullness, as if they had never been alive.
As though burning, as though dying.
Perhaps due to some initial desire for sanitation, or mere curiosity, the Federation had tried to ignite several corpse pyramids. But they had given up before the job was finished. Perhaps they did not want to waste the oil. Perhaps the stink became unbearable. The bodies were grotesque, half-charred spectacles. Hair had turned to ash, and the top layers of skin had turned a crinkling black. But the worst part was that there was something beneath the ashes that looked identifiably human.
The subject is with tears flowing in torrents, groaning in sorrow.
In the square they found bizarrely short skeletons, not corpses, but skeletons gleaming pristine white. They looked at first like children's bones, but upon closer examination, Enki identified them as adult torsos. He bent down and touched the dirt where one skeleton was fixed to the ground. The top half of the body had been stripped clean so the bones glistened in the sunlight, while the lower half remained intact in the dirt.
"They were buried," he said, disgusted. "They were buried up to the waist and set upon by dogs."
Rin could not understand how the Federation had found so many different ways to inflict suffering. But each corner they turned revealed another instance in the string of horrors. Barbarian savagery matched only by inventiveness. A family, arms still around each other, impaled upon the same spear. Babies lying at the bottoms of vats, their skin a horrible shade of crimson, floating in the water in which they'd boiled to death. In the hours that had passed, the only living creatures they encountered were dogs unnaturally fattened by feeding on corpses. Dogs. And vultures.
"Orders?"
Unegan finally asked Alton. They looked to their commander. Alton hadn't spoken since they had walked through the city gates.
His skin had turned a ghostly shade of gray.
He might have been ill. He was sweating profusely, his left arm trembling. When they reached another pile of charred corpses, he convulsed, sank to his knees, and could not keep walking. This was not Alton's first genocide. "This is Spear again," Rin thought. Alton must have been imagining the massacre of Spear in his mind, imagining the way his people were slaughtered overnight like cattle. After a long time, Chagan extended his hand to Alton. Alton grasped it and rose to his feet. He swallowed, closed his eyes. A mask of detachment spread across his expression once more with a curious ripple, like a facade of indifference had formed a seal over the surface of his face, locking any vulnerabilities within.
Spread out,
Alton ordered. His voice was impossibly level.
Find any survivors.
Surrounded by death, spreading out was the last thing any of them wanted to do. Suni opened his mouth to protest.
But the Federation...
The Federation isn't here. They've been marching inland for a steady week. Our people are dead. Find me survivors.
They found evidence of a last desperate battle near the southern gate. The victors were clear. The militia corpses had been given the same deliberate treatment as the carcasses of the civilians. Corpses had been stacked in the middle of the square. Neat little piles with bodies arranged carefully on top of one another. Rin saw the broken flag of the militia lying on the ground, burned and smeared with blood. The flag bearer's hand was detached at the wrist. The rest of his body lay several feet away, eyes blank and unseeing. The flag bore the dragon crest of the Red Emperor, the symbol of the Nikara Empire. In the lower left corner was stitched the number 2 in old Nikara calligraphy. It was the insignia of the 2nd Division. Rin's heart skipped a beat. Kitai's division. Rin dropped to her knees and touched the flag. A barking noise sounded from behind a pile of corpses. She looked up just as a dark, flea-matted mongrel came running at her. It was the size of a small wolf. Its gut was grotesquely round, like it had been gorging for days. It dashed past Rin toward the flag-bearer's corpse, sniffing hopefully. Rin watched it rooting around, salivating eagerly, and something inside her snapped.
"Get away!"
she shrieked, kicking out at the dog. Any Synegardian animal would have slunk away in fear, but this dog had lost all fear of human beings. This dog had lived amid a juicy feast of carnage for too long. Perhaps it assumed that she too was close to death. Perhaps it thought fresh meat would taste better than rotting flesh. It snarled and lunged at her. Rin was caught off guard by the dog's tremendous weight. It knocked her to the ground. It slobbered from open jaws as it lunged for her artery, but she raised her arms in defense and it sank its teeth into her left forearm instead. She screamed out loud, but the dog did not let go. With her right arm she reached for her sword, unsheathed it, and shoved it upward. Her sword found its way through the dog's ribs. The dog's jaws went slack. She stabbed again. The dog fell off her. She jumped to her feet and jammed her sword down, piercing the dog's side. It was in its death throes now. She stabbed it again, this time in the neck. A spray of blood exploded outward, coating her face with its warm wetness. She was using her sword like a dagger now, bringing her arm down again and again just to feel bones and muscle give way to metal, just to hurt and break something.
Rin!
Someone grabbed her sword arm. She whirled on him, but Suni pulled her arms behind her back and held her tightly, so that she could not move until her sobbing had subsided.
You're lucky you didn't get your sword arm,
said Enki.
Keep this on for a week. See me if it starts to smell.
Rin flexed her arm. Enki had bound the dog bite tightly with a poultice that stung like she had stuck her arm in a hornet's nest.
It's good for you,
he said when she grimaced.
It'll prevent infection. We don't need you to go frothing mad.
I think I'd like to go frothing mad, said Rin. I'd like to lose my head. I think I'd be happier.
Don't talk like that,
Enki said sternly.
You have work to do.
But was it really work, what they were doing? Or were they deluding themselves that by finding the survivors, they could atone for the simple truth that they were too late? She continued her miserable work of combing through the empty streets, upending debris, searching homes whose doors had been smashed in. After hours of looking, she stopped hoping to find Kitai alive, and started to hope she wouldn't find his corpse during her patrols, because the sight of him flayed, dismembered, jammed into a wheelbarrow with a pile of other corpses, half-burned, would be worse than never finding him at all.
She walked Golan Nis alone in a daze, trying to both see and not see. In time, she found herself inured to the smell, and eventually the sight of bodies was not a shock. Just another array of faces to be scanned for someone she knew. All the while she called Kitai's name. She screamed it every time she saw a hint of motion, anything that could be alive. A cat disappearing into an alley, a pack of crows taking off suddenly, startled by the return of humans who weren't dead or dying. She screamed it for days. And then from the ruins, so faintly she thought it was an echo, she heard her name in response.
"Remember that time I said the trials were as bad as Spear?" Kitai asked. "I was wrong. This is as bad as Spear. This is worse than Spear."
It wasn't remotely funny, and neither of them laughed. Rin's eyes and throat were sore from weeping. She had been clutching Kitai's hand for hours, fingers wound tightly around his, and she never wanted to let go. They sat side by side in a hastily constructed shelter half a mile outside the city, the only place they could escape the stench of death that permeated Golan Nis. Kitai's survival was nothing short of a miracle. He and a small band of soldiers from the 2nd Division had hidden for days under the bodies of their slain comrades, too afraid to venture out in case the Federation patrols should return. When it looked like they could sneak away from the killing fields, they hid in the demolished slums of the eastern side of the city. They had pulled a cellar door away and filled the open space with bricks, so from the outside it just looked like a wall. That was why the Psyche hadn't seen them on their first pass through the city. Only a handful of Kitai's squadron was still alive. He didn't know if the city contained any more survivors.
"Have you seen Najah?" Kitai finally asked. "I heard he was being shipped to Kirtaline."
Rin opened her mouth to respond, but a horrible prickling feeling spread from the bridge of her nose to under her eyes, and then she was choking under wild, heaving sobs, and she couldn't form any words at all. Kitai said nothing, just held his arms out in wordless sympathy. She collapsed into them. It was absurd that he should be comforting her, that she should be the one crying, after all that Kitai had survived. But Kitai was numb. For Kitai, the suffering had been normalized, and he couldn't grieve any more than he already had. He was still holding her when Kata ducked into the tent.
"Yer Chen, Kitai?"
She wasn't really asking. She just needed to say something to break the silence.
"Yes."
"You were with the 2nd Division when—"
Kata trailed off. Kitai nodded.
"We need you to brief us. Can you walk?"
Under the open sky, in front of a silent audience of Alton and the twins, Kitai recounted in a halting voice the massacre at Golan Nis.
"The city's defense was doomed from the start," Kitai said.
"We thought we still had weeks, but you could have given us months and the same thing would have happened."
Golan Nis had been defended by an amalgamation of the 2nd, 9th, and 11th divisions. In this case, greater numbers did not mean greater strength. Perhaps even worse than in Kirtaline, the soldiers of the different provinces felt little sense of cohesion or purpose. The commanding officers were rivals, paranoid with distrust, unwilling to share intelligence.
"Irja begged the warlords over and over again to put aside their differences. He couldn't make them see reason."
Kitai swallowed.
"The first two skirmishes went badly. They took us by surprise. They surrounded the city from the southeast. We hadn't been expecting them so early. We didn't think they had found the mountain pass. But they came at night. And they captured Irja. They flayed him alive over the city wall so that everyone could see. That broke our resistance. Most of the soldiers wanted to flee after that. After Irja was dead, the 9th and 11th surrendered en masse. I don't blame them. They were outnumbered, and they thought they'd get off easier if they didn't resist. Thought maybe it'd be better to become prisoners than to die."
Kitai shuddered violently.
They were so wrong. The Federation General took their surrender with all the usual etiquette. Confiscated their arms, corralled the soldiers into prison camps. The next morning they were marched up the mountain and beheaded. There were a lot of deserters from the second after that. A couple of us stayed to fight. It was pointless, but it was better than surrendering. We couldn't dishonor Irja. Not like that.
Wait, Chagan interrupted. Did they take the Empress?
The Empress fled, Kitai said. She took 20 of her guards and stole out of the city the night after Irja died.
Kara and Chagan made synchronous noises of disbelief, but Kitai shook his head warily.
Who can blame her? It was that or let those monsters get their hands on her. And who knows what they would have done to her.
Chagan did not look convinced.
Pathetic, he spat,
and Rin agreed with him. The idea that the Empress had fled from a city while her people were burned, killed, murdered, raped, went against everything Rin had been taught about warfare. A general did not abandon his soldiers. An empress did not abandon her people. Again the Talwu's words rang true.
A leader abandons their people. A ruler begins a campaign. Joy in decapitating enemies. This signifies evil.
Was there any other way to interpret the hexagram, in the face of the evidence of destruction before them? Rin had been torturing herself with the Talwu's words, trying to construe them in any way that didn't point to the massacre at Golan Nis. But she had been deluding herself. The Talwu had told them exactly what to expect. She should have known that when the Empress had abandoned the Nikara, then all truly was lost. But the Empress was not the only one who had abandoned Golan Nis. The entire army had surrendered the city. Within a week, Golan Nis had more or less been delivered to the Federation on the platter, and the entirety of its 500,000 people subjected to the whims of the invading forces. Those whims turned out to have little to do with the city itself. Instead, the Federation simply wanted to squeeze Golan Nis for whatever resources they could find, in preparation for a deeper march inland. They sacked the marketplace, rounded up the livestock, and demanded that families bring out their stores of rice and grain. Whatever couldn't be loaded up on their supply wagons, they burned or left out to spoil. Then they disposed of the people.
They decided that beheadings took too long, so they started doing things more efficiently, said Kitai. They started with gas. You should probably know this, actually. They've got this thing, this weapon that emits yellow-green fog. I know, Alton said. We saw the same thing in Curtaline. They took out practically the entire 2nd Division in one night, said Kitai. Some of us put up a last stand near the south gate. When the gas cleared, nothing was alive. I went there afterward to find survivors. At first I didn't know what I was looking at. All over the ground you could see animals. Mice, rats, rodents of every kind. So many of them. They'd crawled out of their holes to die. When the militia was gone, nothing stood between the soldiers and our people. The Federation had fun. They made it a sport. They threw babies in the air to see if they could cleave them in half before they hit the ground. They had contests to see how many civilians they could round up and decapitate in an hour. They raced to see who could stack bodies the fastest.
Kitai's voice cracked.
Could I have some water?
Kara wordlessly handed him her canteen.
How did Mugen become like this? Chagan asked wonderingly. What did you ever do to make them hate you so much?
It's not anything we did, said Alton.
His left hand, Rin noticed, was shaking again.
It's how the Federation soldiers were trained. When you believe your life means nothing except for your usefulness to your Emperor, the lives of your enemies mean even less. The Federation soldiers don't feel anything.
Kitai nodded in agreement.
They don't think of themselves as people. They are parts of a machine. They do as they are commanded, and the only time they feel joy is when reveling in another person's suffering. There is no reasoning with them. There is no attempting to understand them. They are accustomed to propagating such grotesque evil that they cannot properly be called human.
Kitai's voice trembled.
When they were cutting my squadron down, I looked into the eyes of one of them. I thought I could make him recognize me as a fellow man, as a person, not just an opponent. And he stared back at me, and I realized I couldn't connect with him at all. There was nothing human in those eyes.
Once the survivors began to realize that the militia had arrived, they emerged from their hiding holes in miserable, straggling groups. The few survivors of Golan Nis had been driven deep into the city, hiding in disguised shelters like Kitai, or locked up in makeshift prisons, and then forgotten when the Federation soldiers decided to continue their march inland. After discovering two or three such holding rooms, Alton ordered them, psych and civilians alike, to carefully search the city. No one disagreed with the order. They all knew, Rin suspected, that it would be horrible to die alone, chained to walls when their captors had long since departed.
"I guess we're saving people for once,"
Baji said.
"Feels nice."
Alton himself led a squad to take on the nearly impossible task of clearing away the bodies. He claimed it was to ward against rot and disease, but Rin suspected it was because he wanted to give them a proper funeral, and because there was so little else that he could do for the city. They had no time to dig mass graves on the scale necessary before the stench of rotting bodies became unbearable, so they stacked the corpses into large pyres, great bonfires of bodies that burned constantly. Golan Nis turned from a city of corpses to a city of ash. But the sheer number of the dead was staggering. The corpses Alton burned barely made a dent in the piles of rotting bodies inside the city walls. Rin didn't think it was possible to truly cleanse Golan Nis unless they burned the entire city to the ground. Eventually they might have to, but not while there could still be survivors. Rin was outside the city walls trying to find a fresh source of water that wasn't spoiled with blood when Kitai pulled her aside and reported that they had found Venka. She had been kept in a relaxation house, which was likely the only reason why the Federation had let a division soldier live. Kitai did not elaborate on what a relaxation house was, but he didn't need to. Rin could hardly recognize Venka when she went to see her that night. Her lovely hair was shorn short, as if someone had hacked at it with a knife. Her lively eyes were now dull and glassy. Both her arms had been broken at the wrist. She wore them in slings. Rin saw the angle at which Venka's arms had been twisted, and knew there was only one way they could have gotten like that. Venka hardly stirred when Rin entered her room. Only when Rin closed the door did she flinch. "Hi," Rin said in a small voice. Venka looked up dully and said nothing. "I thought you'd want someone to talk to," said Rin, though the words sounded hollow and insufficient even as they left her mouth. Venka glared at her. Rin struggled for words. She could think of no questions that were not inane. "Are you all right?" Of course Venka was not all right. How did you survive? By having the body of a woman. What happened to you? But she already knew.
"Did you know they called us public toilets?"
Venka asked suddenly. Rin stopped 2 paces from the door. Comprehension dawned on her, and her blood turned to ice.
"What?" "They thought I couldn't understand Mugini,"
Venka said with a horrifying attempt at a chuckle.
"That's what they called me. When they were in me."
"Venka,
do you know how badly it hurt? They were in me. They were in me for hours and they wouldn't stop. I blacked out over and over, but every time I awoke they were still going. A different man would be on top of me. Or maybe the same man. They were all the same after a while.